Hachette Audio presents The Fifth Heart, written by Dan Simmons, read by David Pitu. This book is dedicated to Richard Curtis, my invaluable agent and dear friend and fellow fan of both baseball and Mr. Henry James. Part 1. Chapter 1. In the rainy March of 1893, for reasons that no one understands, primarily because no one besides us is aware of this story, the London-based American author Henry James decided to spend his April 15th birthday in Paris, and there, on or before his birthday, commit suicide by throwing himself into the Seine at night. I can tell you that James was deeply depressed that spring, but I can't tell you for a certainty why he was so depressed. Of course, there had been the death in England from breast cancer of his sister Alice a year earlier, on March 6, 1892. But Alice had been a professional invalid for decades and had welcomed the diagnosis of cancer. Death, she told her brother Henry, was the event to which she'd always been anticipating with the greatest enthusiasm. At least in his letters to family and friends, Henry had seemed to support her in her eagerness for an ending, down to describing how lovely her corpse had looked. Perhaps this unchronicled depression in James was augmented by the problem of his work not selling well over the immediately preceding years. His 1886 novels, The Bostonians and The Princess Casamassima, both influenced by Alice's slow dying and her Boston marriage relationship with Catherine Loring, had been a major sales disappointment for all concerned, both in America and England. So by 1890, James had turned his quest for riches toward writing for the theater. Although his first melodramatic stage offering, The American, had done only moderately well, and that only in the provinces rather than in London, he'd convinced himself that the theater would turn out to be his ultimate pot of writer's gold. But already by early 1893, he was beginning to sense that this hope was both illusion and self-delusion. Just as Hollywood would beckon literary writers to their doom for more than a century to come, the English theater in the 1890s was sucking in men of letters who, like Henry James, really had no clue as to how to write a successful stage production for a popular audience. Most biographers would understand this sudden, deep depression better if it were early spring of 1895 rather than March of 1893, since his first major London play, Guy Domville, 2 years hence, will see him jeered and booed when he foolishly will step onto the stage to take his author's bow. Most of the paying spectators in the hall, as opposed to the many glittering ladies and gentlemen in attendance to whom James sent complimentary tickets, will have never read a novel by Henry James. Most will not know he had written novels, and thus they will boo and jeer the play based on its merits alone. And Guy Domville will be a bad, bad play. Even a year from now, after January of 1894, when his friend Constance Fenimore Woolson will throw herself to her death from a high window in Venice, possibly, some shall whisper, because Henry James had not come to stay near or with her in Venice as he'd promised, we know he will have to fight off a terrible depression tinged with real guilt. By the end of 1909, the elderly James will fall into his deepest depression yet, one so deep that his older, and dying from a heart condition, brother William will cross the Atlantic to literally hold Henry's hand in London. In those years, Henry James will be mourning the disastrously low sales and lack of profit from his 1906 to 1908 New York edition of his works, an exhausting project to which he donated 5 years of his life, rewriting the long novels and providing lengthy introductions to each piece. But that final depression was 16 years in our future in this March of 1893. We have no real clue as to why James was so terribly depressed that spring, nor why he suddenly decided that suicide in Paris was his only answer. One factor may have been the severe attack of the gout that James had suffered that cold English winter of 1892 to 93, cutting down on his daily walks and causing him to put on more weight. Or it could have been the simple fact that his upcoming birthday in April was his 50th, a landmark that has brought depression to stronger men than the sensitive Henry James. We'll never know. But we do know that the reality of that depression and his plan for self-annihilation by drowning in the Seine on or before his April 15th birthday is where this story begins. So, in mid-March 1893, Henry James, he dropped the junior sometime after his father died in 1882, wrote from London to family and friends, saying that he was taking a short leave from the daily duties of composition to celebrate spring and my own mid-century anniversary in sunlit Paris before joining my brother William and his family in Florence later in April. James had no intention of ever going to Florence. Carrying some of his sister Alice's purloined ashes in a snuffbox, James left his tidied-up apartments in De Vere Gardens, burned some letters from Miss Woolson and from a few younger male friends, took the boat train to Cherbourg, and arrived in the City of Light the next evening on a day darker and wetter and colder than any he'd suffered that March in chilly London. There, he settled into the Westminster Hotel, on the Rue de la Paix, where he'd once stayed for a month when he was writing several stories in Paris, including a favorite of his, The Pupil. But this time, settled in was not the correct phrase. He had no intention of spending the weeks there until his birthday. Besides, the fares at the Westminster were too extravagant for his current budget. He did not even unpack his steamer trunk. He did not plan to spend a second night there. Or, he decided on a whim, a second full night anywhere on this earth. After a wet, cold day walking in the Jardin des Tuileries and a dismal, lonely dinner, given his resolve, he'd made no effort to contact any of his Parisian friends or other acquaintances who might have been passing through Paris. Henry James drank a final glass of wine, tugged on his woolen overcoat, made sure that the sealed snuffbox was still in his pocket, and, with the bronze tip of his still-folded umbrella tapping on wet cobblestones, set off in the drizzle and darkness for his chosen final destination near Pont-Neuf. Even at his portly gentleman's gait, it was less than a 10-minute walk. The ultimate man of the written word left no note behind. Chapter 2. The place James had chosen from which to leave this life was on the north side of the river less than 60 yards from the broad, well-lighted bridge of Le Pont Neuf. But it was dark there below the bridge, even darker on the promontory along the lowest level of walkways where the black, cold waters of the Seine swirled around the base of moss-darkened stone. Even in the daylight, this promontory was little used. Prostitutes, James knew, sometimes frequented the place at night, but not on a cold and drizzling March night such as this. Tonight they stayed close to their hotels in Pigalle, or stalked their furtive patrons in the narrow lanes on either side of the glowing Boulevard Saint-Germain. By the time James had umbrella-clacked his way to the narrow esplanade promontory that he'd picked out in the daylight, it had been just as he'd remembered it from earlier trips to Paris. He could no longer see to find his way. Distant street lamps across the Seine were ornamented with ironic halos by the rain. The barges and water taxis were few this night. James found his way down the final steps to the esplanade more by feel than by sight, and tapped his way slowly beyond them like a blind man with a cane. Somewhere seemingly very far above, the usually distinctly pronounced sounds of carriage wheels and horses' hooves were muffled and made more distant, almost less real by the worsening rain and deeply puddled thoroughfares. James could sense and hear and smell the river's imminence rather than see it in the near total darkness. Only the rather shocking emptiness of the point of his umbrella suddenly finding empty space ahead brought him to a stop at the edge of what he knew to be the short, curved promontory. There were no steps going down to the river here, he knew, only a 6 or 7 foot drop to the swirling black waters. The Seine ran fast and deep and wicked here. Now he could take one step forward into emptiness, and it would be done. James removed the small snuff box from his inner pocket and stood running his fingers across it for a moment. The motion made him remember a squib in the Times the previous year that claimed that the Eskimo of the Arctic made no artwork to view, but shaped certain smooth stones to enjoy by touch during their many months of northern night. This thought made James smile. He felt he had spent enough of his own months in the northern night. When he'd purloined a few pinches of his sister's ashes the previous year, Catherine Loring waiting just outside the door at the crematorium where she'd come to claim the urn she would take back to Cambridge and the James's corner of the cemetery there, it had been with the sincere plan of spreading them at the place his younger sister had been most happy. But as the months passed, James had realized the impossibility of that idiot's mission. Where? He remembered her brittle happiness when they were both much younger and had traveled in Switzerland with their Aunt Kate, a lady as literal as Hamlet's by-the-card gravedigger. Alice's already pronounced penchant for hysterical illnesses had receded somewhat during those weeks free from her larger family and American home, and his first thought for his 50th birthday was to travel to Geneva and spread her ashes where he and she had laughed and matched wits, with poor Aunt Kate understanding none of their ironic wordplay, happily teasing each other and Aunt Kate as they walked the formal gardens and lakeside promenades. But in the end, Geneva did not feel right to James. Alice had been play-acting her recovery from her destined life of invalidism during that trip, just as he had been play-acting his collusion with her brittle high spirits. The point of land near Newport, then, where she'd built her little house and lived in apparent health and happiness for a year or so. No, that had been her early days with Miss Loring, and James felt more grimly in every month that had passed since Alice's death. Miss Catherine P. Loring had had enough time and way with his sister. Not Newport. So in the end, he could think of no place to spread these few pitiful ashes where Alice had truly been happy. Perhaps she had glimpsed happiness, never really seized it, only during those months or years in Newport and then Cambridge, before what she called that terrible summer, when her oldest brother William and Alice Gibbons were married on July 10th, 1878. For years, William, her father, her brother Harry, brothers Bob and Wilkie, and an endless succession of visitors to their homes had kept up the joke that William would marry her, Alice James. Alice had always acted irritated at the running joke, but now, after her years of self-imposed invalidism and death, Henry James realized that she'd begun to believe in that marriage to William and had been all but destroyed when he married someone else. And someone else named, with cruel irony, Alice. As she'd once put it to Henry James, that summer of William's marriage had been when she went down to the deep sea and the dark waves clouded over her. So now, this night, this final night, James decided that he would merely hold tight to the snuff box with its remnants of Alice's ashes as he stepped forward and fell into the black water and oblivion. To do this, he knew he would have to shut his author's imagination down. No wondering in the second it will take to step forward as to whether the water will be freezing cold or whether, as the filthy water of the Seine began to fill his lungs, his atavistic urge for survival would cause him to thrash around, try to swim to the unclimbable mossy stone of the promontory. No, he had to think of nothing but leaving his pain behind. Empty his mind of everything, always the hardest thing he'd ever tried to do. James moved 1 foot forward, beyond the edge, and suddenly realized that a dark shape he'd taken for a post was really the outline of a man standing not 2 feet from him. Seeing the dim outline of the soft hat pulled low, and the silent figure's aquiline profile half hidden by the turned-up collar of a traveler's cape coat, James could now hear the man's soft breathing. With a stifled gasp, James took two clumsy steps backward and to the side.
"Pardonnez-moi, monsieur. Je ne t'ai pas vu là-bas," he managed to say.
It was the truth. He hadn't seen the man standing there.
"You're English," said the tall form.
The man's English had a Scandinavian accent. Swedish? Norwegian? James was not sure which. Yes, James turned to go back up the steps and away from this spot. At that moment, a rare, for the season, bateau mouche, part water taxi steamer, part tour boat, passed by, and by the sudden light from the boat's starboard lanterns, James could clearly see the tall man's face.
"Mr. Holmes," he said almost involuntarily.
In his surprise, he stepped backward toward the river. His left heel went over the edge, and he would have ended up in the water after all if the tall man's right arm hadn't shot out with lightning speed. Long fingers grasped James' coat front in an amazingly firm grip, and with one jerk, the man pulled Henry James back onto the promontory. Back to his life.
"What name did you just call me by?"
asked the man, still tightly gripping James' coat front. The Scandinavian accent was gone now. The voice was distinctly upper-class British and nothing else.
"I'm sorry," stammered James. "I must have been mistaken. I apologize for intruding upon your solitude here."
At that second, Henry James not only knew the identity of the tall man, despite blacker hair than when he'd met him 4 years earlier, fuller hair somehow, now raised to odd spikes rather than slicked back, and a thick mustache that had been lacking 4 years ago, combined with a nose slightly altered with actor's putty or some such, but also knew that the man had been on the verge of throwing himself into the Seine when James had interrupted him with his arrival in the darkness, announced by the tap, tap, tap of his ferrule. Henry James felt the fool at that moment, but he was a man on whom nothing was ever lost. Once he'd seen a face and learned its name, he never forgot. He tried to move away, but the powerful fingers still gripped the front of his coat.
"What name did you call me by?"
demanded the man again. His tone was as chill as iron in winter.
"I thought you were a man I'd met named Sherlock Holmes,"
gasped James, wanting only to get away, wanting only to be back in his bed in the comfortable hotel on the Rue de la Paix.
"Where did we meet?" demanded the man. "Who are you?"
James answered only the second part.
"My name is Henry James."
In his sudden panic, he'd almost added the long-abandoned Junior.
"James," said Mr. Sherlock Holmes. "The younger brother of the great psychologist William James. You are the American scribbler who lives in London much of the time."
Even in his intense discomfort of being held and touched by another man, James felt an even stronger resentment at being identified as being the younger brother of the great William James. His older brother had not even been known outside of small, tight Harvard circles until he'd published his The Principles of Psychology 3 years earlier in 1890. The book, for reasons somewhat lost on Henry, had catapulted William to international fame among intellectuals and other students of the human mind.
"Please be so kind as to release me at once," said James in as stern a tone as he could muster.
His outrage at being handled made him forget that Holmes, he was certain it was Sherlock Holmes, had just saved his life. Or perhaps that salvation was another mark against this hawk-nosed Englishman.
"Tell me when we met, and I shall," said Holmes, still gripping the front of James's overcoat. "My name is Jan Sigurdsson. I am a Norwegian explorer of some renown."
"A thousand apologies then, sir,"
said James, feeling absolutely no apology in his heart.
"I am obviously mistaken." For a second here, in the darkness, I thought you to be a gentleman I met 4 years ago at a tea party benefit in Chelsea. The party was given by an American lady of my acquaintance, Mrs. T.P. O'Connor. I arrived with Lady Woolsey, you see, along with some other writers and artists of the stage. Mr. Aubrey Beardsley, Mr. Walter Besant, Pearl Craigie, Marie Corelli, Mr. Arthur Conan Doyle, Bernard Shaw, Genevieve Ward. During the tea, I was introduced to Mrs. O'Connor's house guest for the weekend, a certain Sherlock Holmes. I see now that there is no real resemblance.
Holmes released him.
Yes, I remember now. I was there at Mrs. O'Connor's estate briefly, while solving a series of country home jewel thefts. It was the servants, of course. It always is.
James straightened the front of his overcoat, arranged his cravat, firmly planted the tip of his umbrella, and resolved to leave Holmes's presence without another word. Ascending the dark steps, he realized with a shock that Holmes was walking beside him.
"It's amazing, really,"
said the tall Englishman in the slight Yorkshire accent James had heard at Mrs. O'Connor's tea party in 1889.
"I've used this Sigerson disguise for the past 2 years and passed close by, in daylight, personages I've known for years, without their recognizing me. In New Delhi, in broad daylight in a sparsely populated square, and for more than 10 minutes, I stood next to Chief Inspector Singh, a man with whom I'd spent 2 months solving a delicate murder in Lahore, and the trained professional never glanced at me twice. Right here in Paris, I have passed by old English acquaintances and asked directions of my old friend Henri-Auguste Lauzet, the recently retired prefect of police for Paris, with whom I'd worked on a dozen cases. With Lauzet was the new prefect de la Somme, Louis Lépine, with whom I have also had a close working relationship. Yet neither man recognized me. And yet you did. In the dark. In the rain. When you had nothing but self-murder in your mind.
I beg your pardon, said James.
He stopped out of sheer shock at Holmes's effrontery. They were on the street level now, and the rain had subsided a bit, but the numerous street lamps there still held their halos.
Your secret is safe with me, Mr. James, said Holmes.
He was trying to light his pipe despite the damp. When the match finally flared, James could see even more easily that this was the consulting detective whom he'd met at Mrs. O'Connor's tea party 4 years earlier.
You see,
continued Holmes, speaking now between puffs on the pipe,
I was there for the same purpose, sir.
James could think of no reply to that. He turned on his heel and headed west along the sidewalk. Holmes caught up to him with 2 strides of his longer legs.
We need to go somewhere for a late meal and wine, Mr. James.
I prefer to be alone, Mr. Holmes.
Mr. Sigerson, whomever you are pretending to be this night. Yes, yes, but we need to talk,
insisted Holmes. He did not seem angered or perturbed by being found out, or frustrated that his own suicide by Sen had been interrupted by the writer's arrival. Only fascinated that James had seen through his disguise.
We have absolutely nothing to discuss, snapped James,
trying to walk more quickly, but only making himself look foolish in a portly way as the tall Englishman easily kept pace.
We could discuss why you are ending your life with your sister Alice's ashes in a snuff box clenched so tightly in your right hand, said Holmes.
James came to a full stop. After a moment, he managed,
You cannot know such a thing.
But I do, said Holmes, still working with his pipe. And if you join me for a late snack and some good wine, I shall tell you how I know and why I know you will never complete the grim task you assigned yourself tonight, Mr. James. And I know just the clean, well-lighted cafe where we can talk.
Holmes grasped James' left elbow, and the two began walking arm in arm up the Avenue de l'Opéra.
Henry James was too shocked and astonished and curious to resist.
Chapter 3. Despite Holmes's promise to lead them to a well-lighted place, James expected a dimly lighted, out-of-the-way cafe opening onto some back alley. Instead, Holmes had brought him to the Café de la Paix, very near James's hotel, and at the intersection of Boulevard des Capucines and Place de l'Opéra in the 9th arrondissement. The Café de la Paix was one of the largest, brightest, and most vividly decorated establishments in all of Paris, rivaled in its elaborate décor and number of mirrors only by Charles Garnier's Opéra directly across the plaza. The place had been built, James knew, in 1862 to serve guests at the nearby Grand Hôtel de la Paix and had come into its full fame during the Expo exhibition of 67. It had been one of the first of Paris's public buildings to be lighted by electricity. But as if the hundreds or thousands of electric bulbs were not enough, bright lanterns with focal prisms still threw beams of light onto the grand mirrors. Henry James had avoided the place over the decades, if for no other reason than it was a common saying in Paris that to dine in the Café de la Paix meant one would eventually run into friends and acquaintances. The place was that popular, and Henry James preferred to choose the times and places that he would run into old acquaintances or friends. Holmes seemed undisturbed by the crowds, the roar of conversation, and scores of eager faces looking up as they entered. James listened as the faux Norwegian explorer requested his usual table from the maitre d', in fluent and properly accented French, and they were led to a small round table somewhat away from the primary hustle and bustle of the buzzing establishment.
"You come here often enough to have a usual table?"
asked James when they were alone, or as alone as they could be amidst such bustle and noise.
"I've dined here at least 3 times a week in the 2 months I've been in Paris," said Holmes. "I've seen dozens of acquaintances, former police partners in my detection business, and clients. None have looked twice at or through my Jan Sigerson disguise."
Before James could respond, the waiter appeared, and Holmes had the effrontery to order quickly for the both of them. After designating a rather good champagne, and perhaps due to the late hour, he ordered a huge after-opera assortment for two: Le Lièvrine Civé, Pâté Crémeuse de Poutre, accompanied by a Plateau de Fromage Affiné, and a concurrent platter of La Figue, L'Abricot, Le Pruneau, Or marmalade des fruits secs au thé Célin et biscuits spéculoos, concluding with mousse légère chocolat. James had no appetite. His delicate stomach was upset by the shocks of the past hour. More than that, he did not care for hair, especially jugged hair with the heavy and grainy French wheat sauce ladled on it, and this night he had no taste whatsoever for the fruit. And after indulging in it far too much when he was a small boy in France, he detested chocolate mousse. He said nothing. James was dying to know how Holmes, this cut-rate street-corner magus, knew that Sister Alice's ashes were in the snuffbox, but he would die rather than bring up the subject here in this public place. It was true, however, that between the din of chatting, laughing diners, and the placement of their table, it would have been terribly hard for anyone to eavesdrop on them. But that was not the issue. As they sipped the rather good champagne, Holmes said,
"Did you read my obituary in the Times almost 2 years ago?"
"Friends brought it to my attention," said James.
"I read it. The paper was 3 weeks old. I was in Istanbul at the time, but I did get to read it. That and the later interview with poor Watson describing my death at Reichenbach Falls while struggling with the Napoleon of crime, Professor James Moriarty."
Henry James would have preferred to stay silent, but he knew he was expected to fulfill his role as interlocutor.
"How did you survive that terrible fall, Mr. Holmes?"
Holmes laughed and brushed crumbs from his bristling black mustache.
"There was no fall," There was no struggle. There was no Napoleon of crime.
No Professor James Moriarty? Said James. Holmes chuckled and dabbed at his lips and mustache with the white linen serviette.
None whatsoever, I'm afraid. Invented from whole cloth for my own purposes. Purposes of disappearance in this event.
But Watson has told the Times of London that this Professor Moriarty had authored a book. The Dynamics of an Asteroid, persisted James.
Also invented by me, said Holmes with a smug smile under the Sigerson mustache. No such book exists. I cited it to Watson only so that he could later give the press and his own inevitable publication of the events preceding Reichenbach Falls in his only recently released tale, The Final Problem, some, what do you authors call it? Verisimilitude. Yes, that's the word. Verisimilitude.
But might not, said James. After this detail had been mentioned in the various newspaper accounts of Moriarty and your demise, might not people attempt to find this Dynamics of an Asteroid book, even if just out of simple curiosity? If it does not exist, your entire Reichenbach Falls story must collapse. Holmes laughed this away with a flick of his hand.
Oh, I stress to Watson, who has in turn stressed to the press, that Moriarty's book was of the most unreadable and difficult advanced mathematics. I believe my exact words to Watson were, it was a book which ascends to such rarefied heights of pure mathematics that it is said that there was no man in the scientific press capable of criticizing it. That should give pause to the merely curious. I also remember telling Watson that so few copies of Moriarty's famous book, famous within mathematical circles only, were published that copies were extremely rare, perhaps not even findable today.
So you deliberately lied to your friend about this Napoleon of crime, only so that Dr. Watson would repeat these total fabrications to the press? Said James, hoping that the chill in his tone would get through to Holmes.
Oh, yes, said Holmes with a slight smile. Absolutely.
James sat in silence for a while. Finally, he said,
But what if Dr. Watson were called to give sworn testimony? Perhaps in an inquest into your demise?
Oh, any such inquest would have been completed long before this, said Holmes. It's been almost 2 years since Reichenbach Falls, after all.
But still, began James,
Watson would not have been perjuring himself in such testimony, interrupted Holmes, showing the slightest hint of irritation now, because he sincerely believed that Moriarty was, as I explained to him in such detail, the Napoleon of crime. And Watson believes with equal sincerity that I died with Moriarty at Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland.
James blinked several times despite his best effort to show no reaction to this.
You have no remorse about lying to your best friend? The press has reported that Dr. Watson's wife has died in the interval since your disappearance. So presumably the poor man is now mourning the loss of both his wife and his best friend.
Holmes helped himself to more fruit.
I did more than lie, Mr. James. I led Watson on a merry chase, pursuing the mythical Moriarty, you understand, across England and Europe, ending at the fabled waterfall from whose waters neither my body nor Professor Moriarty's shall ever be recovered.
That was beastly, said James.
That was necessary, Holmes said with no anger or emphasis. I had to disappear completely, you see. Disappear without a trace, and in a manner that convinced the multitudes, or at least that small share of the multitudes that has shown interest in my modest adventures, that I was dead. Was there much mourning in London upon news of my demise?
James blinked at this and was sure it was levity. Sure, that is, until he saw the serious expression on Sherlock Holmes' disguised face.
Yes, he said at last, or so I hear.
Holmes waited. Finally, he said,
Watson's telling of the Reichenbach tale, his story called The Final Problem, appeared in The Strand only 3 months ago, December of 92. But I'm curious about the reaction when the news stories appeared 2 years ago.
James resisted a sigh. I don't read The Strand, he said, but I'm told that young men in London, both when the news of your death was first published and then again this winter when Dr. Watson's story appeared, started wearing black armbands. It was true that James would never read the kind of cheap romance fiction and casual science fact and household gossip that appeared in The Strand, but his younger friends Edmund Goss and Jonathan Sturgis both did, and both had worn black mourning armbands for months in solemn memory of Holmes' presumed death. James had thought it all ridiculous. Sherlock Holmes was smiling as he finished the last of his mousse. Henry James, still terrified that the conversation would turn back to the contents of his snuffbox if Holmes were allowed to guide it, said,
But why carry out such a hoax, sir? Why betray your good friend, Dr. Watson, and thousands of your loyal readers with such a ruse if there were no grand criminal conspiracy, no Napoleon of crime pursuing you? What could be your motive? Sheer perversity?
Holmes set his spoon down and stared directly at the writer.
I wish it had been something so simple, Mr. James. No. I decided that I had to fake my own death and disappear completely because of discovering through my own ratiocination, through the inductive and deductive processes by which I've become the most famous consulting detective in the world. A fact so shocking that it not only irrevocably changed my life, but led me, as you found me tonight by Le Pont Neuf, ready to end it.
What single fact could possibly, began Henry James, and then closed his mouth. It would be the worst of manners and presumptuousness to ask. Holmes smiled tightly.
I discovered, Mr. James, he said as he leaned closer, that I was not a real person. I am, how would a literary person such as yourself put it? I am, the evidence has proven to me most conclusively, a literary construct, some ink-stained scribbler's creation, a mere fictional character.
Chapter 4. Henry James now knew beyond a doubt that he was dealing with a crazy person. Something had driven this Sherlock Holmes person, if this was the Sherlock Holmes he had met 4 years earlier at Mrs. O'Connor's garden party, to and beyond the raveled edge of rationality. But the perverted truth was simple and shocking. James was fascinated with Holmes's delusion that he was a fictional character, and he wanted to hear more about it. It struck him as a wonderful conceit for a short story someday, perhaps one involving a famous writer who also had descended into believing that he was one of his own characters. Holmes had ordered cognac, a poor choice, James thought, after the champagne and late evening meal, but both men sipped it now as the writer worked to pose his questions. Suddenly, a noisy commotion erupted in the terrace-covered area of the cafe, across the wide dance floor from where they were seated. Dozens of people had gotten to their feet. Men were bowing. A few applauded.
It's the King of Bohemia, said Holmes.
Henry James wondered if he should humor the madman across from him, and then decided not to.
There is no King of Bohemia, Mr. Holmes, he said flatly. That is the Prince of Wales. I've heard that he dines here from time to time.
Holmes, not sparing another glance at the royal party across the crowded room, sipped his cognac.
You really have not read any of Watson's chronicles of me in the Strand, have you, Mr. James?
Before James could reply, Holmes continued,
One of his first published stories of our adventures, if indeed John Watson was the chronicler or author of these adventures, was titled Scandal in Bohemia, and dealt with an indelicate case
a former prima donna of the Imperial Opera of Warsaw, using a certain photograph to blackmail for romantic indiscretions a very famous member of a certain royal house. Watson, always discreet, invented the King of Bohemia in his clumsy attempt to disguise the royal gentleman's true identity, which was, of course, our very own Prince of Wales. In truth, the scandal was the second time I'd helped the prince out of a jam. The first time was with a potential scandal dealing with a debt incurred in card games. Holmes smiled above the rim of his cognac glass. There is, of course, no Imperial Opera of Warsaw either. Watson there was doing his earnest best to disguise the Paris Opera.
You are making up for Dr. Watson's attempts at discretion with amazing indiscretion, murmured James.
I am dead, said Sherlock Holmes. A dead man has little use for discretion.
James glanced over to where the Prince of Wales was at the center of a laughing, bowing, fawning circle of dandies.
Since I have neither read nor heard of the story, chronicle of your scandal in Bohemia adventure, he said softly, I must presume that you reclaimed the blackmailing adventuress's incriminating photograph for the prince.
I did, and in a most clever manner, said Holmes, and laughed out loud.
In the noise of the busy restaurant, no one seemed to notice.
And then the woman stole it back from me, leaving a framed portrait of herself in its place.
You failed, in other words, said James.
I failed, said Sherlock Holmes, completely, miserably.
He took another sip of his cognac.
I've been bested by very few men in my career, Mr. James. Never before or since by a woman.
James noticed that he uttered that final word with a strong tone of contempt.
Does this have anything to do with your recent revelation that you are not a real person, Mr. Holmes?
The tall man across the table from James rubbed his chin.
I suppose I really should ask you to address me as Sigerson, but tonight I do not care. No, Mr. James, the ancient case of the Prince of Wales and his former paramour, may she rot in peace, has nothing whatsoever to do with the reasons for me realizing that I am not, as you said earlier, real. Would you care to hear those reasons?
James hesitated only a second or two.
Yes, he said.
Holmes set his empty glass down and folded his long-fingered hands on the tablecloth.
It began, as so many things in life do, with simple domestic conversations, he began. Those who have read Dr. Watson's chronicles in the Strand are aware, from certain background information he has given, that in 1880 the good doctor was removed from the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers, then on duty in India, to the Berkshire's 66th Foot. On 27 July of that year, Watson was severely wounded during the Battle of Maywand. For many weeks, his life teetered in the balance. The intrusive piece of lead had been a Jezail bullet, that kind of heavy slug fired by the long, heavy musket so commonly used by the rebels in Afghanistan, and it had done serious internal damage. But Watson lived, despite the heat and flies and primitive regimental medical care available to him, continued Holmes. In October of 1881, he was dispatched back to England on the troop ship Orontes.
I fail to see how this proves or disproves, began Henry James.
Patience, said Holmes,
holding up one long finger to command silence.
The wound from the Jezail bullet was in Watson's shoulder, said Holmes. At various times, in Turkish baths, and once when we had to strip to swim a river while on one of my adventures, I saw the ugly scar. But Watson had no other wounds from the wars.
Henry James waited. A waiter came by, and Holmes ordered black Turkish coffee for the both of them.
But 5 years ago, I remember the date in 1888, said Holmes,
Watson's spidery shoulder wound from the Jezail bullet had suddenly become a bullet wound he was complaining of, even in print, in his leg.
Could there not have been two such wounds? Asked James. One in the poor man's shoulder, the other in his leg. Perhaps he received the second wound in London, during the course of one of your adventures.
A second Afghan Jezail bullet? Laughed Holmes. Fired at Watson in London? Without my knowledge? It would seem highly unlikely, Mr. James. And added to that improbability are the twin facts that Watson was never wounded, never shot, during any of our adventures he chronicled. And, this I find most interesting, the original shoulder wound that I'd seen, a terrible spiderweb of scars and a livid entry wound still visible, simply had disappeared when Watson began talking and writing about his leg wound.
Distinctly odd, said James. He wondered what he should do if this Holmes Sigerson person, almost certainly an escaped patient from some secured madhouse, should suddenly grow violent.
And then there is the fact of Dr. Watson's wives, said Holmes.
James merely raised one eyebrow at this non sequitur.
He has too many of them, said Holmes.
Dr. Watson is a bigamist, then?
No, no, laughed Holmes.
Their coffee arrived. It was far too bitter for James's taste, but the madman seemed to enjoy it.
They simply come and go, as if they flicker in and out of existence, primarily depending upon what I take to be a fiction author's need to have Watson living with me at our apartments at 221B Baker Street or not. And their names keep changing almost at random, Mr. James. Now a Constance, then Mary, then no name at all, then Mary again.
Wives have a way of dying, said James.
That they do, thank God, said Holmes, nodding in agreement. But in reality there is usually some warning of that, some illness, and, failing that, some period of mourning for the widower. Watson, bless his heart, simply moves in with me again, and our adventures continue apace. Between these mythical wives, I mean.
Henry James cleared his throat, but could think of nothing to say.
Then there is the odd fact of our residence itself,
bore on Holmes, taking no clue to stop based on his interlocutor's obvious boredom.
I have lived, Watson and I have lived, at 221B Baker Street since shortly after we met in January of 1881.
Is there a paradox in that? Asked James.
When these doubts of mine began and multiplied in the winter and spring of 1890 and 1891,
Holmes said very softly, I went to the office of the city surveyor and looked at the most recent maps of our neighborhood. As of 1891, a full 10 years after we took up residence at 221B, the residences and structures on Baker Street ended at number 85.
Incredible, muttered James.
But mostly, continued Holmes, as if he'd not heard Henry James speak, it is the cloudiness, lack of daily detail, emptiness, for me, of the periods between my actual cases that most makes me doubt my existence separate from some fictional page. It is as if I'm alive, real, only when investigating a case.
Could not your disposition toward indulging in certain drugs account for that? Asked James.
Holmes laughed and set his coffee cup down with a clatter. You do read my adventures in the Strand, after all.
Not at all, said James. But as I mentioned, some younger friends of mine do. I remember their commenting on your frequent injections of cocaine, was it not?
James well remembered Edmund Gosse's fascination with Holmes's dependence upon the drug. It had made Henry James suspect that Gosse himself had experimented with injecting it upon occasion.
Only a 7% solution, laughed Holmes.
quite tame by any opium-eater's scale. But since my death on 24 April 1891, I have successfully cured myself of that self-indulgence.
Very good, said James. How did you manage that?
By the replacement use of a much less harmful injected substance called morphine, said Sherlock Holmes. And in the past weeks, I have discovered an even more miraculous and innocuous replacement, distilled by our German friend who created aspirin, Mr. Bayer himself, a drug so habit and side-effect-free that both Bayer and those who use it have named it after its heroic qualities.
Yes, said James.
It is called heroin, said Sherlock Holmes, and I look forward to finding greater and less expensive quantities of it in America when you and I go there next week. Morphine has been sold in abundance on the streets of the United States, much more so than in England, since so many tens or hundreds of thousands of wounded soldiers continued to use it after their civil war 30 years ago. And now this heroic heroin, while not yet released to the general marketplace, is becoming equally abundant there.
James was goggling at the tall man. We're going to America?
We? We're leaving for Marseille and a steamship bound for America early in the morning, said Holmes. There is a 7-year-old murder there in their capital city that I am duty-bound to solve. And it is in your very deep interest, compelling interest, my dear James, for you to accompany me. I could not in good conscience leave you behind in Paris while you are in this melancholic and possibly still self-destructive state of mind. Besides, you will enjoy this. The game's afoot, and we're called to it as certainly and inescapably as your next story or book calls to your creator's soul and writer's pen.
Holmes beckoned for the waiter to bring the bill and paid it while James sat there with his eyes still wide and his mouth hanging unbecomingly open. Chapter 5. In the 10 days that followed, while crossing the Atlantic from France to New York and then taking a train to Washington, D.C., Henry James felt as if he were in a dream. No, not so much in a dream. His dreams tended to be specific and colorful and powerful, but rather in a fog, a delicious and dangerous and decision-free fog. They sailed from Marseille on the older French liner, the Paris. James thought he remembered being aboard her 12 years before, the last time he'd visited America, when he'd hurried home to Cambridge during the period when first his mother and then his father had been dying. Sherlock Holmes refused to take a more modern English steamship, since it would mean a stop somewhere in England on the way. The Paris paused only briefly in Dublin, and Holmes would not set foot in England, he said, until he was fully satisfied. Satisfied as to what was not further defined at that time, but James had to guess that it related to the subject of the consulting detective's real versus fictional existence. There had been 5 amazing conversations, revelations in truth, during the past 10 days before landfall in New York, and James had to sort them out not only by content, but by the context of where they had been announced. The first had been outside his hotel on the Rue de la Paix after their late evening dining on the night they had met. It is, of course, absurd to think that I can or should wish to go to America now, James had said, holding his umbrella in both hands like a weapon.
But you must, said Holmes in calm terms. My case depends upon it.
Case? Repeated Henry James. I thought you had left being a consulting detective behind when you faked your own death almost 2 years ago.
Not a bit of it, said Holmes. Even as Jan Sigerson, I did my bit of detecting in Turkey, India, and elsewhere. But that was for my brother Mycroft, for Whitehall, and for England. Now I find I must take up a private case again, solve what is almost certainly an apolitical mystery.
James continued to hold his folded umbrella at port arms. The rain had stopped.
Let me guess, he said. In Dr. Watson's absence, you need me to chronicle your adventures, to be your Boswell.
Sherlock Holmes laughed loudly enough that the sound echoed back from the nearby stone buildings.
No, no, not at all, Mr. James. Nor do I think such a role as Boswell would suit you in any event, but certainly not in writing up the details of a mystery.
James' spine stiffened a bit at that. He considered himself capable of writing any sort of story, as long as neither its topic nor style was beneath his dignity. And he had done a few of those stories for money in his youth.
What I mean, continued Holmes, is that while I have not had the pleasure of reading your novels and shorter fiction, Mr. James, many of my more literary acquaintances, including Watson himself, have. And from what they tell me, your rendering of the most exciting adventures you and I might have in America would end up with a beautiful young lady from America as the protagonist, various lords and ladies wandering through, verbal opaqueness followed by descriptive obtuseness, and nothing more exciting being allowed to occur in the tale than a verbal faux pas or tea service being late.
James wondered whether he should be and act offended, but decided that he was not. All in all, he was amused.
Then you could have no conceivable need for my presence in this quixotic jaunt to America you seem about to undertake, sir.
Ah, but I truly do, Mr. James, said Holmes. I need you for introductions, for information, for American context, for, what did you call it earlier? For cover, and for companionship. I shall be a stranger in a strange land, and to solve this mystery I shall need your help. Do you wish to hear more of the reasons for this?
James said nothing. His thought had already turned away from suicide in the Seine toward the soft bed in his hotel room a few dozen paces and a lift ride from where he stood in the darkness.
In March of 1891, almost exactly 2 years ago, continued Holmes,
either unaware of or indifferent to James's very obvious lack of interest,
I had a visit at my bachelor quarters at 221B Baker Street from a prospective client. The distressed gentleman was an American. The topic was murder in the American capital, and his name was Edward Hooper. He showed me $3,000 that he was willing to pay me if I came with him to America and solved the mystery of his sister's death. I accepted only $1 as my retainer, but it has taken these 3 years for me to become active in the mystery.
No, I do not know, nor have I heard of,
began James, and then stopped abruptly.
I believe you knew Mr. Edward Hooper's sister, Marion Hooper Adams, said Holmes.
Clover,
James said so softly that he could hardly hear the two syllables himself.
Clover Adams, said Henry James. From the time she was a girl, everyone called Marion Hooper Clover. It suited her.
You knew her well, then?
Pressed Holmes.
I have been friends with Henry Adams for many, many years, said James. He wished he could will himself not to speak of any of this, but this night he seemed under some strange compulsion to break confidences he normally would have guarded with his life. I was also close to Clover Adams, as close as anyone could be to such an intelligent but unpredictable and frequently melancholic woman. I was a guest in their home the last time I was in America in the early 1880s.
You know the public details of her death, then, said Holmes.
There was a strange light in the consulting detective's eye, James thought, but it could have been a reflection from one of the gas lights that still illuminated this section of the Rue de la Paix.
Her death by suicide,
James said in a sharper tone than he might have intended.
By her own hand. Seven and a half years ago now. It is ancient history for all but the most closely bereaved, such as her husband Henry and her dear friends, a category which includes me.
On 6 December, 1885,
Holmes said quietly.
The date is part of the mystery presented to me by her brother, Mr. Edward Hooper.
James started to say that he had never had the pleasure of actually meeting Clover's brother Edward, that Clover and Henry had always referred to him as Ned, but instead he heard himself snapping words like a whip. Death by sad suicide, Mr. Holmes. Everyone agreed to that. Her husband Henry, my particular mutual friend and neighbor to the Adamses, Mr. John Hay, the doctor, the police, the newspapers, everyone agreed that she had taken her own life. She was of a melancholic nature, you see. All of us who knew and loved Clover Adams had known that. A tendency toward melancholy and even self-murder ran in the Hooper family. And she was in a deep, perhaps irrecoverable mourning for her father, who had passed away earlier that year. She had been very close to her father, you see, and nothing that Henry Adams or anyone else could do in the months following Mr. Hooper's death seemed capable of breaking the iron bonds of loss and melancholy that had closed around poor Clover. James stopped. He was almost panting from the intensity and exertion of his little speech. He felt like a fool for saying so much. Holmes reached